Do you like the work we're doing here at It's All Journalism? For as little as $1 a month, you can help us continue the conversation about good journalism. Show your support by donating to our Patreon campaign. Go to itsalljournalism.com and follow the link at the top of the page to donate.
When we're competing with another outlet, whether it be The Post or WAMU or DCist for a story, that forces us to think about our angle and what additional interview can we do, what additional reporting can we do. And that competition really benefits readers in DC. And I think all journalists, you know, you hate the person that gets your story better than you, but you don't want them to go away, I don't think.
Welcome to It's All Journalism. I'm Michael O'Connell, here with another podcast about digital media. And this is sort of our follow-up or our prequel, or I think this is like a Star Wars, what number this is. I'm not sure, because we've got Alexa Mills back in the studio. Welcome back.
Thank you, Michael.
And I say welcome back, and nobody's actually heard the other interview yet. That's actually going to be a part of what we're doing here today. I sort of teased to it in last week's episode the reason why we sort of held Alexa's episode. I should also say that Nicole Ogrisco is here as well.
Hey, everybody.
But anyway, back to Alexa. You reached out to us right as we were in the production of putting the final pieces on your previous interview, saying that the Washington City paper is for sale.
Yep, that's what happened. We were for sale. I found out we were for sale last Friday. And then shortly after, I realized, oh no, I don't want Michael to publish a podcast that is out of date. So okay. I called you back.
Right. Yeah. And most of the podcasts, as you'll hear, you know, we talk about a lot of other things, about some of the stuff that you did before you came to the city paper. But, you know, I understand. Yeah, of course. Let's go in. And the fact that the city paper is for sale, I mean, that's something worth talking about. I mean, I think you said before we turn on the mics, it's been a bad week for alternative newspapers because the LA Weekly is also up for sale.
Yeah. And, you know, actually, I know so little about, I have, you know, gotten the snippets that other alt weeklies have faced sales or different things this week, but I actually know so little about them that I almost hesitate to say. Yeah.
The point is, you know, this is not news because not too long ago, you know, the city paper in Baltimore had gone up for sale, and they've been sort of trying to figure out a nonprofit model. So what's been the reaction of the city paper staff here in D.C.?
You know, the interesting thing is that I think within city paper, the edit side, at least where I am, we've been really high energy. I said right away, you know, there's no profit in us being sad sacks. We love journalism, so let's have a great time reporting and let's have a great time seeing if we can figure this out. So, you know, our regular writers have been stayed 100% focused on their beats, except for my one who happened to be on a rare vacation and missed most of this. But Jeff, our Loose Lips reporter, and Laura, our food reporter, have been full force ahead in their beats. My arts editor, Matt Cohen, sort of took on the sub-beat of starting to cover the sale and cover our options. So he's been super busy, and everybody else inside, you know, we've just been working really hard.
The city paper has, there are a lot of alums who are still in journalism. Have any of the previous editors reached out to you?
Yes, I have spoken to every previous editor who lives in D.C., and they were supportive of me from well before the sale, just giving me advice on the role and during the sale. Two out of four of them, maybe even more, lived through a sale. So they had a lot of information and ideas.
So just because there's a sale doesn't necessarily mean the paper's going away. It just, you know, it's going to change ownerships. There's going to be something else, I guess.
You know, no one knows the future. I don't. But my read is that city paper could go away. I mean, or it could shrink, or we could reinvent it. So I think those are the three basic scenarios we're seeing.
So it certainly it's tough times for the alternative press anyway, whatever the turnout is in here. What are your thoughts about that, about, you know, sort of the state of the alternative press at this point?
You know, I know about city paper. I'm there every day. I'm not an expert on the alternative press nationally. But what I will say is that I think at city paper, you know, talking with my staff yesterday, we feel like we have the alternative press DNA, and that means a lot of great things. But we also feel like we're DC's local newspaper. We cover less than we want to, but we see a world where we actually, you know, take on more beats and really become even more so DC's local newspaper. The Post does less and less every month with local. Their focus, thank goodness, is on national, and they're killing it. But we are killing it locally. We dominate in our beats, which are, you know, food, housing. And then, you know, Jeff Anderson is Loose Lips. I mean, he's been doing pieces recently on guns that no one else is doing. And that's our thing. I mean, there's a world where we have an education reporter and we're killing it in education, too. Or, you know, I have a reporter on staff who wants to be a social justice reporter. Cover what are people doing locally around the increase in protests? What is the situation of local immigrants? These kinds of things. We'd love to do health. I'd love to have a sports reporter, you know, so and more. I mean, I'm just sort of listing off the top of my head. But I mean, you know, we could go on or there could be a conversation with the public about what kinds of news, you know, what news beats they want. But, you know, I think that Alt Weekly, there's a paper in New Haven. We wrote an article about it, City Paper, this week. It's called The New Haven Independent. And it was an Alt Weekly guy who in 2005, his name is Paul Bass. I guess he saw the writing on the wall in New Haven, you know, changes in the way information is delivered. He ended up launching a new site called The New Haven Independent. It's an online only news site. And what he said, I think he said in our article, was that he had the DNA of an alt weekly, but he's New Haven's, you know, he's a new the news site. So I think that's one way we're thinking about it.
So, I mean, I think maybe you've sort of elaborated on that and talking about a lot of the things that the city paper does. I mean, what happens, what is to DC when it loses this sort of strata of coverage?
That's a good question. I mean, DC gets less coverage. You know, I don't know, you know, who fills the gap. But I will say that I think that competition is important in news. And that, you know, one thing we've heard from other outlets is they do want us there. I mean, DCist put an article out about what our situation yesterday. You know, when we're competing with another outlet, whether it be The Post or WAMU or DCist for a story, that forces us to think about our angle and what additional interview can we do? What additional reporting can we do? And that competition really benefits readers in DC. And so I think all journalists, you know, you hate the person that gets your story better than you, but you don't want them to go away, I don't think. So I think that the media market for local news in DC is not saturated. And we want to stay there. We want to participate.
Okay. And have you heard from the public at all about this? Has the news spread enough so that you're starting to get feedback from your readers?
Yes. Our social media guy, Will, yesterday at the end of the day said it was our biggest day for social media he's ever seen. We've been publishing articles. Other, you know, as I mentioned, DC has put something out, Washingtonian had put something out a little bit earlier. You know, for what it's worth, we've heard people saying, don't go away. You know, we hope you stay.
It's just that easy. They just tell you not to go away.
Yeah, we've heard. I mean, with the article we put about the New Haven Independent as well as a newspaper in Austin, Texas, it was about the two. They have the same model. They had a nonprofit model. We put out that article and people said, oh, you know, I'd pay for City Paper. I'd pay for a subscription or, you know, basically volunteer donation, reader donation or a subscription. So, you know, that sentiment does not mean that it's necessarily going to happen. There has to be a plan. There has to be an action to get there. But that's the basic sentiment.
So is there a timeline that's there now as to what's going to happen and when?
Timeline that we have is our parent company, Southcom, is asking for, I think, like initial offers of interest from prospective buyers by November 1st. So that's a really short time with the goal of a sale date, I think, by end of the calendar year. So I think they said December 29th. But anyway, that's the basic. November 1st, want to know you're interested.
So how does something like that affect the news process for you guys? So you said that you're covering yourself, but what does it mean for long-term projects and planning?
I mean, I book covers 3 months in advance. So right now we're booked through about early February, I mean, everybody's working on their articles. The rest of the book, the long form stuff, yeah, we plan 3 months in advance, but our regular writers are moving with the news, so they don't plan that far in advance. They're just working.
So how big a staff do you have? I think I might have asked that in our last interview.
We are 10 on the edit side. With that includes a staff photographer, Darrow Montgomery, 30 years documenting DC. You know, it includes a design person and an editing and reporters. It could be 9. I think it's 10. I never know if I'm counting myself or not. So I get that number off.
So, you know, you started as the editor not too long ago. I mean, what are your thoughts about yourself and your career and moving forward? You know, and maybe it's tough that, you know, what plans can you make when everything seems so uncertain?
You know, I decided to become a journalist when I was 32, which is both old, and it was in a period of time when journalism, you know.
Yeah, you picked a sucky career to get into.
So I think that I came into journalism truly out of passion. Job security was not my expectation. That's not my framework even coming into this. So,
well, you got that lack of security.
So, I mean, we're just living in the moment. Anybody can become a freelancer. I truly don't know. I don't know. I mean, right now we're working on City Paper.
Okay.
So, yeah.
All right. Well, we're going to go ahead and sort of fold this into the previous interview that you did. Alexa, thanks for coming back in. This has been great. I wish you luck. We're going to keep in contact and touch with you to sort of see how this unfolds, and maybe we can do some sort of follow-up.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks for coming in. So we met at the Association of Alternative News Media's annual conference here in D.C., had a real pleasant conversation. And one of the things I remember when we were talking is you had kind of an unconventional, maybe it's conventional, maybe a lot of people don't know about it, but you didn't go to journalism school. You didn't set out to be a journalist. You know, how did you get to be the editor of the City Paper?
Well,
this is where you answer.
I mean, it's been a long road. My first job out of college was here in D.C. I worked in the victim advocacy unit at the city courthouse, working with people who were looking for an order of protection from someone who's abusing them or stalking them. At that time, it was almost all women seeking orders against men. And I don't know if that has changed in years, but it was a tough job. It was a burnout job. I was super young. I ended up going back home to Boston after about 2 years and went on to grad school in city planning at MIT and had a tremendous experience there. I graduated from MIT right at the sort of height of the financial crisis. The sort of predatory lending story unfolded while I was in school, and the economy was really bad. People's feelings about the economy were really bad. And MIT offered me a full-time job doing media production about cities. So there was a position within a little lab called Community Innovators Lab, right in the urban planning department. And the director, Dana Cunningham, said, just come in and create stories about cities. And, you know, she had grant money. And so I went right into it. I loved her. I loved the work. I did it for about 5.5 years, but I was itching to, I mean, I was among scientists, you know, I was among city planners, and it was MIT, and you'd say, I'd ask someone, what do you think about this sentence? Or, you know, is there a better way to tell the story? And you just get sort of a blank stare, you know, comparable to when I ask my colleagues about math now at the City Paper. The answer is like, you know, I don't do math. At MIT, it was the opposite. It was sort of like, I don't do sentences. And I wanted it, you know, I wanted to be part of an industry and be getting better at a craft. So I tried to switch to journalism, and I did. And it was really hard. It was really, really hard.
What was hard about it? Was it just you're in a completely different lane now, trying to think differently?
Yeah, it was. I mean, I was in Boston. I mostly tried and did write for The Globe. And I was just standing outside this. It was so many different things. I was completely confounded by how you would get an article in the newspaper. Like, it seemed like rocket science to me. How do you pitch? What do you write? Why did editors not write back? I mean, at MIT, you would write back to every email. It'd be very strange to not return an email you got at MIT.
And editors don't return emails all the time. I couldn't understand why someone wouldn't just write back. I cared deeply what they thought of me, which was a new experience at MIT. I never really, I mean, of course I wanted to be respected and do a great job, and I did, but I never really thought about, you know, what does this person think of my work? And in journalism, I was concerned with what a certain editor might think. And that was hard, I think, psychologically. So it was a lot of things, but it was a journey.
It's funny, writing, reporting, editing, you know, it's so personal in some ways. And so it's so much of a reflection on you and the effort you put into it. And hopefully the idea that you want to better yourself. So you're hoping for some feedback. Some of it's emotional, but some of it is also just technical. Especially you talk about, you know, editors not returning. I'm sitting here thinking of all the emails that I don't return. Are you returning emails?
No, I was thinking about this. I can't. I really can't.
Now you know.
Yeah. And I mean, I think I don't know if all my experience helps me be sympathetic at all. I mean, there's only so many minutes in a day, and I don't respond to all of them.
So you ended up at, when we met, you were the managing editor at the City Paper. How did you end up there?
I had been writing. So it was so tough. I made the decision. I applied to some journalism schools and, I applied to Northeastern University in Boston. I didn't apply to Emerson or BU. I got it in my mind that Northeastern was the right place. And they welcomed me and they were very generous to me. And I did that program, you know, just working on the degree evenings. It took me, I think, 3 years. I'm not sure. But there was this idea that I was to do a final project. And I'd been working with the Northeastern University Law School. They had a program there. This woman, Professor Margaret Burnham, her life goal or the goal of her program is to do restorative justice for lynching victims, and especially like unknown lynching victims of the 30s and 40s. And she's had students research hundreds of these cases, and they're law students, and they look to restore justice in some way. And she had a tough case, and I'd worked with her on a case before that my reporting, I didn't write the story, my reporting went in the Globe. And then she had this really tough case about this young man, Felix Hall, 20, from Alabama, enlisted to serve in World War II, ended up going to Fort Benning and was lynched on base. And the information we had, I mean, was that this was he had been doing very well in his unit. He was well-liked. He was a very outgoing person, a person with a lot of friends. And the question was, who lynched him and why couldn't the FBI solve the case? So I researched that for quite some time, and the Washington Post ended up taking the pitch through Northeastern, and I published a story, and that put my name in front of a Washington audience. I don't think I'd ever tried to really write, not really write for any national publications. And the editor-in-chief of City Paper, Liz Garrigan, tweeted the story. And about a month later, I was coming to D.C. to sort of meet with my Post editors, and they had me do a little talk about my research process with other journalists there. And so I emailed Liz and said, you know, I'm going to be in D.C. And it seemed like she had a loose lips position open. So I said, is this loose lips position open? I'd be willing to apply if it is. I'd like to apply. And she said, no, that's actually not open. But what I do have open is a managing editor. And do you want to apply? So I said, sure. And I did.
So was that an editing position, or was there some writing involved, reporting?
I did write a little bit. I mean, I did a major story and a couple of minor stories, but I probably spent more time editing.
So the major story you're alluding to is the Slumlord story?
Yep.
Before we get into that, let me sort of back up to the lynching story, the one that you did for the Post. And they brought you in to talk about the research that you did. Could you sort of talk about that process? You know, what did that involve? The research, not talking to the Post.
Researching this lynching was really slow. I involved a lot of patients. Well, first of all, Professor Burnham at Northeastern is like an expert in researching 1930s lynching. So you're working with someone who knows more about how to find information that about that than anyone else. But in that case with Felix Hall, the first thing was to get the FBI file. And it was a massive file. And because the FBI did an investigation, most lynchings the FBI doesn't usually investigate because they're local things. This was on a military base, so the entire document set was pretty much in the federal government. So, yeah, I mean, you put in a document request with the FBI through a FOIA, and then you wait 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, 6 months. I mean, I think the FBI's volume is enormous. I don't know. I mean, we did so much. I went to the National Archives in College Park and just looked through documents, correspondence between generals, correspondence between leaders on the base, helped a lot. At Harvard Law School, I got the papers of William Hasty, who was really high in the War Department. He was an African-American person. He ended up quitting because they treated him like a puppet. He was just the only Black guy in the department at that time. And this was in 41. The military didn't integrate until 48. What else did we get? I ended up getting the papers of a white Southern journalist in North Carolina. His name is escaping me, but he was one of the few papers that he wrote an article for The Nation about this lynching. The College Park National Archives has an entire lynching file, multiple lynching files. So I sorted through those and was able to find multiple letters to the president regarding public outrage that this particular lynching hadn't been solved. So there were a lot of documents. The real win was finally the VA. An archivist in the National Archives has locations throughout the country, and the archivist in St. Louis, Corey Stewart, amazing archivist, found this 500-page VA file on Felix Hall, his record, and all the years, all the fights his family had with the military to make sure they paid them what they said they would, which they did pretty much. That was a huge find. That file enabled me to tell readers that Felix Hall had grown 6 inches between the time he arrived on base and the time he was killed, which was an incredible detail and just showing that this was just a growing young man, so young. And then finally, the FBI named a number of suspects. And the Post said, well, find the suspects and find, if not find their children, find out who did it. And we didn't. I think I know who did it now, but we didn't find confirmation. And I got paired with this researcher at the Post, Alice Kreitz. And together, Alice and I mean, working, you know, we would email like Friday nights at 9 finally, and found the children of every suspect, every FBI agent, several other people on base. I probably, you know, I was able to talk to a number of people who grew up on Fort Benning. One woman, Pearl Follett, lives out in Washington. She remembered the lynching. Her stepfather had been out hunting in the woods of Fort Benning and seen this body and come home really shaken. You know, there's a body in the woods. And she, Pearl, was 12 at the time. So that, with all that, you know, of course, I think Alice Kreitz was able to find Pearl's phone number. So that's how we put it together.
So this seems like an incredible amount of information to have been able to get on this story that was, you know, decades old. How long did you work on that?
You know, that's in the, you know, my mind doesn't serve me well. I probably worked on it at least more than 12 months. I worked on it about a year. But another law student who I never met, her name was Zahava Stern, had worked on it a year before that. And then she'd graduated and handed over what files she had. And then I built on that, all that, you know, she hadn't found relatives yet, but she had a sliver of the FBI file, and then we got more. So this woman, Zahava, laid the foundation. So it was really hard.
So what was the final form of that?
Page one, Sunday. I think it was about 4,000 words. The online presentation. With that VA file, we had photographs of the young man hanging. He had hung for about 6 weeks in the woods that his body has been left there.
Wow.
So we had those photos. Didn't publish the most brutal of them. had a map of the base. We had a video of Professor Burnham talking about these cases.
So what was your takeaway of that process of researching and writing? You know, how'd you feel about it? What did it mean to you?
It meant so many things. I think career-wise, frustrating as this is, I mean, I had 15 job interviews after that came out. And it was sort of frustrating because I was like, come on, guys. I was always good, you know?
Yeah, I hear you.
But that's the way it is. You know, that's the way the world goes. I spent 8 years of my life at MIT, so I know an elite name goes a long way. And so that was interesting. I think I learned an awful lot reporting-wise. Great, tremendous editing from my editors at The Post, Alan Cypress and Cameron Barr. And on a personal level, I struggled and still do with the idea of heaven, actually. I knew from the files, had a very detailed description of the final moments of this young man's life. And I'm raised and am Unitarian Universalist, which isn't a faith that has a strong vision of the afterlife or even commitment to it. Surely you can be an atheist Unitarian or you could be a faithful Unitarian. And so I think personally that was the greatest, just really thinking very, very hard about whether this person could have been welcomed into the arms of some God or if there was some other step for him in life or in death.
So do you feel a degree of frustration at not knowing, but not being able to report who the killers were?
Yes. You know, I think that naming... in the case of any tragedy, naming the perpetrator is part of justice. And that's an aspect of justice that has yet to be served in this case. And that was frustrating. From a writing perspective, it was frustrating because I think the story would have been a different structure if we'd solved it. And that was frustrating. But, I mean, just the layers of injustice involved in this case were frustrating. I mean... At one point, I think I hurled my pen at the wall of my apartment and it shattered. And I remember months later finding pieces of this pen. So
there are a lot of shattered pens behind journalists' couches.
It's just it was really a case where you're seeing this correspondence in high up in the War Department, now called the Department of Defense. It's like just seeing that institutional racism where you're looking at these letters between a white guy and a black guy, or I don't know. And it's hard to describe.
Yeah. And what's interesting is if you think about that, actually serves the story as well, showing the institutionalized racism that, you know, these are the structures which were investigating this very racist act.
Yeah.
And they were imperfect.
Yeah.
And, that is one of the layers of that type of story.
Yeah.
So let's fast forward to, you know, is it 2016, 2017 for the big story that you wrote for the City paper had to do with the slumlord. Could you sort of talk about how that came about and sort of what the scope of the story was?
Yeah, I almost thought of the story before I even got to City Paper. I had had a job offer, and Liz Garrigan gave me a month to move because I wasn't local yet. I wasn't here in D.C., and so I was, like, sitting on the couch at my father's house in Massachusetts, my father and stepmother's house, and I was reading City Paper and getting to know. And I was reading an article by Andrew Giambroni, who I ultimately collaborated with the story on, and it was about Congress Heights, which is a Sanford-owned collection of buildings outside the Congress Heights metro station. And it was just talking about the horrible conditions. And it was about this tenant there, Mr. Green, who we've written about again. And he was Mr. Green was killing rats with his heart medication. But there was this little tiny detail that Andrew had in the story, which was that Mr. Green had a voucher for his units set at, like, I can't remember, but it was like more than $1,000. And that just really struck me. Like, if Andrew had written that Mr. Green's rent was $400 or $600, I don't think I would have thought twice about it, because I would have said, okay, well, it's DC, I know the market, and if you're paying not too much, your rent, landlord might not be able to give too much. But you got a voucher for over $1,000 at Congress Heights, I think it didn't make sense. Why isn't this property in good shape? And so that was our question. And I came to City Paper, and I think I mentioned this question. It probably took me 2 weeks of adjusting, asked the question, and Liz just said, okay, we'll find out. Go ahead, guys. Do it together.
And so what was, you know, how did that develop as a story? What was, you know, it was Sanford Capital was the name of the company. And you sort of tell me the scope of that.
I think the first thing we did, I made this spreadsheet, which I still go back to today, which was a list of all of Sanford's properties, what they bought them for, what they're appraised at. And then we started going to the properties. We met with, you know, the attorney general's office. They were pursuing cases on two of the properties, and we just started learning more and more.
So what was the quote-unquote scam of it, that he was just charging more for what the properties are worth and not putting any investing back into it?
Yeah, two things. I mean, so I started with Mr. Green, who had a voucher, but actually a huge number of Sanford tenants pay rent. Maybe a lot of people will have like a $900 rent bill, which of course is really cheap for DC, but not if you're working at McDonald's, not if you're a school bus driver. And so every property, it was, you know, I went to these properties. I would go all the time. I went to Belmont Crossing. I went to Terrace Manor, went to Congress Heights. I went to Tivoli Gardens up near Fort Totten. And it was always the same. You know, you'd talk to tenants and either one way or another, they had really high rents, whether they were paying or they had a voucher. And in every case, the buildings were same things, you know, front doors don't lock. That's a huge deal. If your front door doesn't lock and you've got a little kid, you know, if your front door doesn't lock, whoever you are, that's your line of defense that would welcome vagrants in. I mean, tons of these properties had vagrants in them. Real typical thing was the laundry room worked. Sanford took over the property. Gradually, the laundry rooms were closed. And then, you know, the laundry room door would be open so that vagrants could live in it. So, you know, it was really consistent across the properties, what you'd see.
You wrote how many stories about this?
Oh, my gosh. I have no idea. Maybe 30 more. I don't know.
Did it generate any recourse? Did it lead to any outcome in the courts?
There was a victory recently. I mean, Sanford's legal strategy has been to fight just tooth and nail. They are fighting every single thing they think they can fight. I think they battle. So the case against Terrace Manor ended up in bankruptcy court in sort of a questionable way. Like, is Sanford really bankrupt? Are they? They're bankrupt on this property, but they also, you know, we got the eviction records. So they strategically evicted everyone. And then they weren't collecting rent. And then a few years later, they claim bankruptcy. You know, so anyway, ultimately, you know, they rounded up these buyers to buy Terrace Manor for $6 million, which other developers say is way over market. And these developers proposed, well, we'll renovate the units at $20,000, which is a joke, right? That's like slap some paint on and carpet the floors. And finally, a big DC developer named W.C. Smith that owns almost all the land around Terrace Manor and owns a great deal of property in D.C., ponied up the $6 million. I don't know if they thought it was over market or under market, but they decided to renovate Terrace Manor for $175,000 a unit. I don't know if that's what, like 8 or 9 times the renovation cost that Sanford sort of chosen buyers. And so W.C. Smith, a private developer, ended up stepping in. There were nonprofit developers who were interested too. It's a win for Sanford because they got this massive price. And it's a win for the tenants because the tenants did always want W.C. Smith as their landlord.
So, but it's not going to be one of these situations where the developer comes in and tries to gentrify it, tries to go for a more upscale tenancy.
You know, I don't think so. I think that W.C. Smith, if I understand, I mean, in a very genuine way, is going to make a nice property and move the tenants back in. I really actually believe that. But what the future holds, I mean, W.C. Smith owns huge amounts of land in that area. And what they'll do with it one day, I don't know. You know, I mean, certainly not today. I don't think that's not what's going to happen. But in 20 years, I couldn't say.
So do you think you'd be writing like this if you didn't have that sort of urban planning background?
The urban planning background helps with Sanford a lot. I mean, more than anything else, that I had like a team of like five real estate developers that I knew personally that I would call all the time and say, well, is this normal? Is this normal? I mean, I had one colleague actually make me a pro forma spreadsheet, which is a pro forma is a typical real estate developer spreadsheet, which I've made in school, but I hadn't done it for 8 years. And so I understood how these properties cash flowed. You know, I knew a lot.
And so that helped.
And that did help. But it was starting from square one, too. I mean, we studied a lot. Andrew Jambroni, who I did this with, and I studied a lot.
Yeah, well, it's a new city. You need to know the ins and outs of the city.
Laws.
Yeah, the laws and the
TOPA, you know, the Tenant Opportunity to Purchase Act is just a weird DC law, I'm pretty sure.
There are a lot of weird DC laws.
Yeah, so we had to learn TOPA. There are other Sanford properties. I mean, Tivoli Garden, which was a Latino majority property at Fort Totten. Mana, a nonprofit developer, bought that. But again, I think Mana met Sanford's purchase price. So again, Sanford got cleaned up, you know, after giving these tenants nothing for years. And Mana is in the process of doing a good job for these.
You know, when we first met, you were managing editor and you were about to become the editor of the city paper. So what has that transition been like?
The first 3 weeks were steep learning curve. I think when, you know, I knew I was going to be the editor, I knew when Liz was leaving. And I think my reaction was to just like take a few days off, stare at the wall. I feel like I knew it was coming, but I wasn't going to try to beat it.
The horror.
And so, you know, day one was, I'm sure I was in that office 14 hours that day. You know, just the first 2 weeks, I barely left. There was one morning I woke up at 2 a.m. and walked to City Paper.
Yeah, you were really optimistic because when we were supposed to talk about 2 months ago, and then you wrote me and says, I think we better push this back a little bit.
Yeah.
Because I think you were in the full weight of it, and you said, nah, maybe I better be working on this.
Yeah, I was like, wow, how am I going to get to 3400 Idaho Ave? I mean, the idea of leaving my desk was not really a great idea that, you know, for those first 3 weeks. But after that, you know, Labor Day weekend was a rest, and then it's been, you know, we're working really, really hard. The other thing was that we promoted up our managing editor, Caroline Jones, the managing editor, had been City Lights. So then we were down City Lights, and that, you know, that created, so my managing editor was doing two jobs, and I was trying to do this whole job that Liz did without, you know, really a full person to be my managing editor. So now all that's ironed out.
Well, good.
And we're full capacity.
So what do you see as the role of the city paper? I mean, this is, you're in D.C. There are a lot of journalists in D.C. There, but, you know, I think the city paper has a sort of particular role in how it covers the city. What's your take on it?
I think city paper's job is to be authentic. I think city's paper's job is to be the paper that's willing to be a little rough and tumble, a little rough around the edges, a little more likely to take a risk. I think it's our job to have the best arts coverage in the city, which I think we do. And our job is to get news, you know, and be real about it, to not, you know, bite the press release bait too much unless it's really something our readers. I mean, sometimes, yeah, you know, a lawsuit comes down, the ACLU calls and tells us, and it is really important for our readers to know that. So, you know, I'm not like against completely press releases, but there was certainly no press release that said Sanford Capital was a giant, massive, you know, slumlord.
That'd be a terrible press release.
Yeah. But, well, I mean, you know, maybe the attorney general would beg to differ and say we sent that. You know, we'd been reporting on Sanford and the Post had a long time. I think that article and then the Post article, what they pointed out was that the scope of the problem was much bigger than anyone had really expected. And the city had its hands in it much more than anyone expected.
Now, the city paper is also, it's, you know, alternative weekly. And, you know, the alternatives have been pretty taken in on the chin a lot in the last, you know, 5-10 years. What are your concerns about, you know, the industry, about, you know, the role of the alternative press?
You know, I think it's important. It's at the front of my mind. We have a great corporate parent at City Paper called Southcom. I'm in touch with some of the other editors in their alt-weekly portfolio. But, of course, you can't escape. I mean, we know about the Baltimore City Paper. We know about the Boston Phoenix and the Village Voice. And
we're really thinking about it. I think one of my top goals is to look at other funding sources. You know, I mean, everybody knows this. The alt-weeklies were built on classifieds, and those dollars are gone. So we're looking at different ways that our readers can participate financially. We're looking at grants. Oh, we do, I mean, from the sales side, we do big events, not just ads. So I think we're looking at everything. I would love to see alt-weekly stop hemorrhaging and be on the other side of that. I think every market's different, but just sitting in the city paper offices, I mean, there's stories we give up every day that we just don't have someone who can do that. I'd love to be getting those stories. I mean, if I hired two people, they could fill a beat in a second. I can think of three beats I'd like to fill. So, you know, I think there's space for it in DC. We have great local coverage, but I think it could be a whole lot better across the boards. So I don't know, you know, maybe that's pie in the sky, but I think the stories are there. The talent is there. There's journalists out there.
Yeah. And, you know, we've said this before on the podcast. I mean, the Post is a pretty big deal, not just in DC, but, you know, across the country, across the world. And they don't always look what's at their feet. There are a lot of things that they're unable to cover because they're like every publication, their resources, their focus are elsewhere. And so there are opportunities here to cover, you know, alternative press type stories in depth and detail. I mean, the Sanford one is a great example. You know, music and arts, another, you know, traditional thing for alts to sort of own. And so there are those opportunities. So I take it you're hopeful then for where you want to go?
Yeah.
Or just realistic?
No, I am hopeful. I'm hopeful. I have ideas. I mean, I've only been in the hot seat for 6 weeks. I had a call with a professor at Northeastern who I knew, Dan Kennedy, who's written whole books on money and publications, and he gave me a list of people to call. So it's, you know, it is in the forefront of my mind, for sure. And, you know, I can't say that I've ever done it before, so I don't know what's to come. But, you know, I just, you know, I'd love to see dedicated education. You know, housing fills a beat. Obviously, that's something we've got. We've got food. We've got an arts section. There's a position that used to be at the city paper that was called City Desk, and it was like a catch-all. And now we fill it in City Desk. I mean, every staff member will do a City Desk every so often. But, you know, that's a fun position, general assignment at Alt Weekly, you know? So I'm definitely hopeful, and we'll see.
Alexa, thanks for coming in. This has been great.
Thank you.
Next time on It's All Journalism.
How are we playing into someone's hands as media, potentially, if we don't know the origins of a story, the origins of as juicy as it might be, and of leaks, I think, now, because there's so many leaks coming out that end up shaping narratives, too. It's like, well, what are the motivations there? What's the backstory? And that's what I think, in terms of, you know, kind of getting to what Ben was saying earlier about what we could do as an industry, is not participating in that and actually really better understanding within every newsroom, how is this potentially shaping my community?
Join us next week when I talk to Mandy Jenkins and Benjamin Decker of Storyful. I caught up with the two of them at the recent Online News Association conference here in Washington, D.C. We had a great conversation about how newsrooms can fight fake news. Do you enjoy listening to the conversations we have here at It's All Journalism? Why don't you donate to our Patreon campaign and help us continue the conversations about digital journalism and where we're going as an industry in the coming years? Go to itsalljournalism.com, follow the link at the top of the page, and donate what you can to show your support for our podcast. But wait, Mike, what's in this for me? You might say. Well, fellow producer Nicole Grisco and I are working on something big, and we're going to be having a big announcement in the coming weeks, so stay tuned. Remember, look for new episodes of It's All Journalism on Thursdays, and you can find all of our episodes at our website, itsalljournalism.com. You can also find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Google Play, and Podcast One. And I discovered recently that you can listen to our podcast on the Alexa Home speaker. Go to the Alexa app on your phone and enable the Spreaker skills. and then ask Alexa to listen to It's All Journalism on Spreaker. This week's episode was produced by Nicole Grisco. Amber Healy wrote our web content. Nick Dupre wrote our theme music, and I'm your host, Michael O'Connell. It's All Journalism is produced in partnership with the Association of Alternative News Media. Thanks for listening.
The Capital Culture Podcast with your hosts, Rachel Nania and Jason Fraley.
We have a new podcast called Capital Culture. Each week, we go in depth with chefs like Marcus Samuelson and writers like Bon Appetit's Adam Rappaport.
We'll also talk plays with Kathleen Turner, movies with Emma Stone, and music with Smokey Robinson. Not to mention some of your favorite WTOP voices.
The Capital Culture Podcast. Find it on iTunes, the Podcast One app, podcastone.com, or at WTOP.com. Search Podcast DC. The Target USA Podcast with your host, J.J. Green.
Russia
could render a huge harm to this country.
North Korea's secret missile
that could touch the whole of the United States.
ISIS.
D.C. is repeatedly mentioned as someplace they would like to see an attack.
This is J.J. Green. Join me each week for the latest on U.S. and international security on Target USA.
The Target USA Podcast. Find it on iTunes, the Podcast One app, podcastone.com, or at WTOP.com. Search Podcast DC.
We're in a period of rapid change, and sometimes it can feel like things are spinning out of control. With political tensions, anxiety, and loneliness rising, and questions about how to live a good life on everyone's mind, finding answers can seem harder than ever. For millennia, spiritual thinkers have offered wisdom and tools to help people find their way in trying times, advice that even a scientist like me, Dave DeSteno, is finding have a lot to offer. To join the conversation, look for How God Works wherever you listen to podcasts.